I'll be quite prudent with time. Let me spend a few minutes talking to you about three or four key topics from my perspective. The first one is around what it really takes to recharge ESCOM from a leadership perspective. And I secondly talk to you about the importance of the success of the turnaround strategy that we've embarked upon, some insights around the data-driven approach that we've taken towards ending load shedding. I'll also discuss what actually happened in the last 3-4 weeks a bit, and touch on the topic of energy transition and the importance of the financing gap that needs to be addressed within the context of all issues that various nation states are concerned with. As a starting point, Alec, I was not born in Soweto. I was born in Rustenburg. I grew up in Brits, so I'm from the maize and tobacco farms of the Northwest. That's the one point, and I apologize. My team needed to check that with you. As an individual, I'm driven by a higher purpose. What I've tried to do in my professional careers is really mix the desire of wanting to succeed within the business space, but also mirror into that aspects of my own personal upbringing of doing good for the country. So this is one of the reasons why I found myself with assignments of the type that you have explained when I could have opted to walk away. It was really about responding to the call to duty, action, where I thought I could add value. I left that business, the ESCOM business, back in 2015 under very difficult circumstances. And anybody who's normal in their heads would not have gone back to that space. But I do recall very explicitly a Saturday afternoon that I spent with my family, and we were going through very intense stage 6 load shedding in my area. When it's late stage 6 load shedding, we experience anything close to 8 hours of no lights, no power. I felt at that point in time that I would probably be a better person in latter years, resting wherever I'll be, knowing that when the need to act came, I raised my hand despite the difficulties that I would have personally encountered. I've a 5-year-old granddaughter, and I owed it to her to raise my hand to ensure that we make this country better for those who come after us, and make it better than how we found it. And that's why I really went back into ESCOM. So for us at ESCOM, under my leadership, our focus is really on delivering three things. The first one is to recover our operations from a generation perspective. The second one is to ensure that we facilitate the transition and the reforms that are anticipated within the industry, knowing that we are a dominant player at the moment, which is quite counterintuitive. The third one is ensuring that the business itself is set up in a manner that is more efficient going forward by implementing the unbundling process. I was chatting to someone this morning and said these are three different jobs that require a lot of presence and that require a lot of dedication. But we're running all of this at the same time. So what is our strategy focused on? Our strategy has got essentially four key pillars. The first one being driving financial and operational sustainability. It goes without question that the irritation that is ESCOM going back to the fiscus now and again is just no longer tolerable by a society. It's a fair point. I mean, the Minister of Finance today is juggling balls, touching up on VAT here and there, looking at where to get money to run some of the social programs or programs that needs to fund programs that are quite important for the country. And at the same time, SOEs like ourselves keep on going back and asking for money. We do look forward to the last part of our financial package out of this, and our intention is to not go back to the state. We're doing everything that we need to deal with to ensure that we do not get to that point. And how we do that is, first of all, to make sure that operationally we perform. We have the lights staying on, we have electricity that we can sell, we keep our costs down, And the next battle that we're going to go into now is collect for the sales that we make from municipalities that do not pay us. Of course, the second part, the second part of our strategy is about facilitating a competitive future energy industry. We have to get the grid expansion going so we can harness the natural energy that is abundant in our country, especially in areas that are distant from infrastructure. This has always been seen like something that Eskom will not do because it's protecting its own monopoly. We are not fazed by that. This board's current leadership is of the view that Eskom remains relevant for our energy industry going forward. All it has to do is to prepare itself for playing in that space. So we have taken decisions as a board, it's supported by shareholder ministry, that will also play in that space. Because if Eskom, which is 102 years old, which we found handed to us by those who came before us, and I saw a fellow Eskomite sitting here now in his retired age, we owe it to those who come after us that we recreate a new Eskom that is relevant with the right mix of technologies for its continued presence within the energy industry. The third part is around modernization of our power system. There's a lot that's been spoken about when it comes to the transmission infrastructure, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the distribution infrastructure. Many of our people's lived experiences have got to do with that last mile of service that they receive from either the municipalities or Eskom itself. And in that space, a lot of underinvestment has taken place, and we need to correct that, and we need to correct that to stay at pace with developments globally, but also enable consumers to move from being consumers to prosumers, as it's already started happening in some of the cities. There's a lot more offering that we can put on the table once we have the relevant investment in the electric power system. The last part, which is also equally important for strategy, is to support the country's net zero emissions by 2050. And I had Adam's comments. I'm watching President Trump and American stance in as far as this is concerned, and we're assessing what are the implications for us. I think as a country, we'll have to take a very pragmatic view that says, what is the path that we need to be following, whilst we also recognizing that climate change is a reality and we do see its impact. We need to keep that balance around the trilemmas of energy in terms of sustainability, affordability, and sustainability all intertwined. I know for a fact that if we replace the megawatts that we have today with clean megawatts, we run the risk of having less jobs in a country that is so high on unemployment than we're doing at the moment. And when you look at the aspects associated with financing the transition, you look at the disproportionate requirement versus what is on the table, the cost of money that's on the table, the expectations for the states to be carrying a bigger chunk of it. And one quickly sees that we do have a challenge in as far as how to finance the transition. And this topic then has to be high up on the agenda. I participate in the G20 energy stream or B20 energy stream. And I think this is going to be a very big topic in terms of how do we fund the transition given the geopolitical shifts that are happening across the world. We already know that the US has pulled out of the JETP funding that is on the table. But we also know that that on its own, what's on the table is nowhere near enough to manage the kind of job losses that will happen. The key issue is what are the creative ways of stimulating the transition in a manner that is acceptable? We've had a good run in the financial year that is coming to an end now. As indicated, 311 days of no load shedding. When we don't load shed the country, we don't have to spend money on expensive diesel. And as a result of that, our finances look much more better. We have to stay in a space where we're running 365 days so that we can then be able to finance operationally, be able to finance our requirements and only look for borrowings to support growth. And for us, that growth is in unfolding our own renewables portfolio. We have ambitious targets, 2 gigawatts by 2029, that we have identified that we will be taking through the motions in the next few months. But there's quite a pipeline that we see being an alternative that we need to roll out to help transition in the towns that are affected by the end of life that will accompany some of our stations. As we indicated in Jan, through the updates that we've given to the markets, we anticipate to make a profit in this financial year when it ends, and we want to stay down that path so we take the first pressure out in terms of Eskom's dependencies. What did we consider in terms of our plans with regards to ending on a path towards load shedding? The plan began in April 2023, now famously known as the Generation Recovery Plan. It is a product of engagement by the then new board and the power station managers and the technical people within the team that really looked at pain points, ranked them, and categorized and prioritized what needed to be done. This affected areas of people, systems, and processes that we needed to check out in the business. And we've really done quite well when you look at what was set out then, a lot of green ticks, and hence we could see the run that started off on March 27th last year until the end of Jan in 2025. What happened? Why did we then see ourselves going through three bouts? As in any plan, it is the sustainability of the interventions on a holistic basis. One of our biggest pain points is the slippages from our outage execution. When we take units out on day X and the plan is to have those units back on day Y, it needs to happen within the timeline because the allocation for maintenance window for other units is based strictly and rigidly on that aspect. Why do you want to do your maintenance on time all the time? Because you have to prepare the whole value chain. The simple availability of the skills you require is a function of time. So you need to be able to get in and get out as quickly as possible or as per the program. When you start having overlap, you create vulnerability in your system because your ability to absorb slight shocks that happens because of the nature and the age of your plant start compounding. And that's really what we saw happening on that Saturday afternoon when we had multiple unit trips. When you have a trip here and there, you guys never get to know about it because the system can absorb it much more better than was the case 2 years ago. We can ride that. We can use emergency reserves, which are designed exactly for that, and then we get the units back. But when you have multiple unit trips, you take a lot of capacity out in a very short space of time, and that makes you vulnerable. So the primary issue for us is to go back and refocus on how do we execute our maintenance in a manner that gives us success and allows us to go in and out in the scheduled window. In this space, we work with our suppliers. We have to think ourselves in terms of how we help our suppliers succeed, and it's now becoming a focal point. It was an issue identified right at the beginning, and it's clearly showing that the extent of its resolution has not given us the comfort that we want. The second issue, of course, is that people matter. In this instance, we deliver everything through our people. Without our people, none of these plans will come to fruition. So I place a lot of emphasis in terms of our engagement, our staff engagement, and how we capacitate them in terms of extra resources and skills and how we support them. Their training becomes important. We need to manage the transition of skills. We've had a workforce that is aged. There's some people living with great experience. We've taken time to blend and bring back some of these skills back in the business. We need to keep at it all the time because some of the small mistakes that people make, not because they mean badly, but because the experience level they have may get them challenged when faced with particular combination of circumstances that they cannot attend to. So we're refocusing on that aspect to get us back on track. We are comfortable that the performance that we saw up to the end of Jan was not a fluke. It's an outcome of very coordinated effort. We just need to, and we have had some tough conversations with our team as late as yesterday, as at one of the power stations, to refocus their minds. This team can deliver. We just need to have that tough talk and team focus for us to go down that path again. What's also important alongside the execution of our maintenance is the aspect of bringing additional capacity. We've always said that we will be in a comfortable zone the moment we have results from our maintenance and our EF is high, our reliability is higher, and additional capacity is on board. We had 2,500 megawatts that we are targeting for bringing on board from a capacity perspective. Just before the end of the year, we brought in Quebec Unit 2 back from its long-term life extension, successfully brought back. It is a unit that had a week's outage. It's performing much more better than before we did the lifetime extension. In fact, we're getting an extra 100 megawatts from that unit, same infrastructure from the refurbishment that we have made. 100 megawatts is equal to an average size of an IPP solar or wind projects. We got that from the existing infrastructure that we have, from the maintenance that we have done and the life extension that we did. What we need to do now is to get Quebec Unit 1 back from refueling. We need to get Kusile Unit 6, the last of the units from Kusile, to come online, and the guys are literally going through the last stages of commissioning. That turbine has been run a few times in the last few weeks and are preparing to take it up to 3,000 revs for us to synchronize to the grid, which we expect to be sometime next week, within this month. When we have that, and we have the repaired turbine at Medupi 4 coming back also within April, we will be in a space where we enter the winter with an additional 2,500 megawatts. Balance that with maintenance outcomes, we'll be in a much more comfortable area, and we can start really focusing on bringing the rest of the capacities that needs to come from the private sector, the IPPs program from the IPPO, and those that are done for private sector investors on. We need to get to a point where energy availability is not a constraint to the economy, and we need to have energy and electricity available in particular to support the growth ambitions that we want as a country. This is our single focus as the current executive team at Eskom. We need to get into a space where we no longer constrain the country's growth potential, and rather we deal with other matters as they arise. And let me touch on the last point, which is the issue of transition. As I said, we've taken a view that we will also proactively transition to change the mix of our technology going forward to manage emissions as part of our response to climate change. But we'll do this in a manner that allows us to be pragmatic, both from balancing the energy security, security of supply perspective, and also dealing with the issues of affordability and impact in terms of society overall. So we are also looking forward to government's overall thought processes now that the world is the way it is, and now that nations do take a very selfish position when it has to come to securing their own rights, and how do we balance that with the fact that there is a reality that we also need to deal with. One of the things that I've said to my team, we have a very big research and development team at Eskom. It's been the case for many years. But since my arrival, I've refocused them on solutions that will help us to show our commitment to responsible use of coal, and the focus in the short term to be more on those interventions. So they are out. As we speak now, they are in Japan. A month ago, they were in China, because I said if others can operate coal in a manner that reduces emissions level, what is it that we should be doing to ensure that we comply with the environmental rules that are put up before us. And I'm quite excited about some of the early breakthroughs that they've made in terms of solutions that can be attached to existing stations to reduce the SO2 levels, for instance, as was witnessed in one of our power stations this week, where we're running a trial and we get sulfur dioxide emission reductions up to 30%. We need to focus on those kind of solutions. And this country, by the way, with its resource levels in coal, ought to have led the technology developments in ensuring that we use that resource more responsibly. But for some reason, we seem to have taken a lull, which is so unengineering given the teachings that I had. We should have been at the forefront of this, in the same way as we were at the forefront of taking coal and converting to liquids. We should have carried on. But that's something else that we're now having to course correct. So in closing off, I just want to reiterate the following points, that from an Eskom perspective, the board and the management team are very driven in as far as those three priorities are concerned. You know, we don't sleep. We spend a lot of sleepless nights, and sometimes we have to be reminded that it's a Monday and not a Sunday or weekend, because we're really going through on this. We have tasted how it feels to have no load shedding for 311 days. We have witnessed the mood changing in the country. We have seen the perception of the country from an investment perspective change. I spent time on investment roadshows in New York and in London late last year, September or so, and the message is beginning to sink. We need to get to a point where this is no longer an issue from an investment perspective. But we also have to deal with issues around driving an ethical high-performance culture. We have changed our structures internally to ensure that we can bring accountability to bear. Where there's been wrongdoing, that there are actions being taken. We're working with the SIU. We've got other agents of the state that are actually doing work with us. There's a number of forensic work that was done in the last 2-3 years. Those files, as they come now, they arrive in a very focused team that takes decisions and disciplinary actions to employees and to also suppliers, because we also have to address these issues of around accountability and clean governance for our people. But for me, I tell you, we take our responsibility very seriously, and I'm very proud to work for Eskom at this point, given what it means for our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Rob Versov and I were in London last month at an event called ARC. So it amongst the speakers was a guy, a chap called Chris Wright, the US Energy Secretary.
Yeah.
And he had a very, very strong message. There was another strong message that came through, and it went something like this. And this is why I'm very confused with all of this. The Chinese are laughing at the Europeans, because the Chinese produce 41% of the carbon emissions. Sorry, 40%. They've gone up to 41%. They are creating 2 coal-fired power stations a week. The British are virtue signaling by cutting their transmissions from the current 1% to 0.5%. And the whole message that came from the US is, this is crazy. You little countries are putting yourself more and more at risk and costing yourself, hollowing out your industry by making your energy prices so expensive to fulfill an objective which just isn't going to be fulfilled, because you've got somebody else who's pumping a heck of a lot more into the system. You did touch on it on a more pragmatic strategy, but if the Americans are going to drill, baby, drill, the Chinese are going to keep making coal-fired power stations. We have 200 to 300 years of coal in the ground, high quality, which we could be using. How dramatic can our change be to change the energy equation in South Africa to one where it becomes low cost again?
Yeah. Alec, I move from a premise that there's evidence that global warming is an issue. We are experiencing it in our own backyards. And we also have to move in a manner that is prudent in terms of what our own contribution and response towards that should look like in relation to our own challenges. I understand that the US has got this extreme position that they have now articulated with President Trump. I don't know what the US position is going to be 4 years from now when President Trump is out of office. What needs to happen is that we need to choose a path that is pragmatic, because it's a no-regret path for us to move on. What is that path for other countries? India. India has all its coal stations still operating. They've done their best to retrofit emission reduction technologies onto them. And they've taken a path that allows new capacity that supports their their growth to be coming from renewables. This is something that we can also follow as a country. It's not an issue of coal or renewables. You actually need to have a blend of this as you expand your base of energy provision going forward. If we do this, this will be, for me, a no-regret stage for South Africa. We have the responsibility to do all that we can to scrub emissions out of our existing stations. And for that, we need to embrace all technologies that are available. And hence, my direction to the team to say we go around the world and we look at what are best technologies for us to use so we can fulfill that part of our responsibility as well.
How big a role can nuclear play, given that it is expensive, but it is zero emissions and it can be very cheap in the long term?
Yeah. Look, Quebec is one of our cheapest stations, cleanest stations. We've ran Quebec for 40 years. We now have an additional 20 years to go with it. When you look at the value for money, that's the way to go. There are 69 reactors being built globally as we speak. On the African continent, we were the only ones operating nuclear. In no time, Egypt is going to overtake us. Countries are investing in nuclear for base loads and given its attributes of essentially being clean. For a country like ours, I argue that we need to look at that. We also need to look at it within the context of the industrialization potential that lies in it. We were the leaders on the continent for a while with all associated value chain. We've not exploited it to the fullest in terms of uranium mining and the fuel production that's associated with it. But there's a space here where when we take that decision, we are able to exploit both nuclear for power and nuclear for other utilizations like in the medicinal space that we are once capable of. As we speak, we are at risk of even losing our technical skills to these countries. What we have to do, of course, is to make sure that the processes associated with nuclear build programs are transparent and very visible to South Africans. Yeah.
There was a lot of talk at ARC as well about the small modular nuclear reactors and that these are becoming increasingly popular around the world. Now, we did have the PBMR here in South Africa, so we were world leaders at one stage. There's all kinds of debate that whether or not we should be dusting off those old plans or not. Can we get back to a leadership position in these small modular reactors?
We're probably a few years late. When we mothballed the PBMR, a lot of the expertise working on these programs emigrated. Many of them are actually in the US. I saw you had a discussion with someone from C5. They've really taken the technology and moved forward on the back of work done in the country here. We are looking at the small modular reactors very, very closely. There are a few that are in or just about to enter commercial stage at about 100 to 150 megawatts. And we see those as being potential options of repurposing and repowering the coal stations that are coming at the end of their life. So we're looking at all technologies across the size.
Your chairman, Nteto Nyati, addressed our investment conference. We have a one-day investment conference in September, and he was the star of the show. Everybody loved Nteto. They loved his message. And I need to follow up with you on the big story that he said. Now that we're getting more efficient supply or sustainable supply of electricity. Okay, we had load shedding, but park that for the moment. We are now focusing on costs.
Yeah.
How much progress have you made on that front?
Well, the fact that we when we forecast profit has got to do with three things. The first one, we did have a tariff adjustment in the year under review. The second one is that we're seeing some very good progress on particular cost lines, especially primary energy, because of that focus. If you ask me, are we where I want to be in terms of cost reductions? No. What are we doing about it? We have refocused the teams. You know, I started off with a team that's made up of internal talent that understands the business well so that we can start looking at the ways of doing things within the business. That's how you engineer out costs. You know, and the second part now is accelerating or deepening the The reduction of cost through a cost efficiency focus rather than cost reduction or cost cutting. The cost cutting component is what the business did every time they were a little bit in a tight corner. It leads to unsustainable business practices, especially in the maintenance space. So we have to do it right, and we're getting additional support to drive that. We have to do that, Alec. We are approaching a market that is going to be liberalized, and you know, it's all about your cost of production. We know in our fleet there are stations that we will probably have to turn down a bit when it comes to a point where the need is not there, simply because we'll have to be competing to have energy into the system here.
He was also telling us about the challenges that come in through renewables, through the high cost of renewables. And that's where my confusion comes in. South Africa bought in completely to net zero. So we're this tiny little speck on the carbon emission world, but we are virtue signaling that we're going to be in the front. Now we're paying for it through higher electricity because the cost of the renewables in our system, in your system, are extremely high. Is there anything that you can do to address that, if only just not to be putting in more and more renewables into the future?
So if you look at the price of a renewable curve, it started off quite high. And as you progressed with bid windows, it started dropping, which is what you expect in the maturing markets. So the price of electricity from renewables is quite competitive now going forward. What we're sitting with and are settled with are legacy contracts that come from the initial stages. But are we accounting for all the costs associated with renewables? I argue the costs that are required for the expansion of the transmission grid as a result of renewables. So where are you accounting for them? Where are you accounting for them appropriately? Secondly, there's technology that is needed to stabilize the grid in a space where you have high volumes of renewables to avoid scenarios where you could have total grid collapse. We've seen this in other countries, and China's experienced it. You need investments in some battery storages or in some pump schemes that allows you the flexibility to respond quite quickly. These are the totality, of course, that needs to be taken into account for renewables. In the long run, we should see the cost of renewables being cheaper.
Just my final question before we go to the audiences. I was in Davos earlier this year where Donald Trump spoke by video and told a very supportive audience at the World Economic Forum that he was going to double the output of electricity in the United States because it is needed to power the AI revolution.
Yeah.
And I looked at that and I thought, you know, we've got an organization called Eskom, which used to be number one in the world.
Yeah.
Isn't this an opportunity, perhaps? We've got space, we've got a great place to stay. If we can get our electricity right, that perhaps we would be producing the energy here rather than the United States doing it on that side, pulling in the data centers, etc. Are these things that are on your longer term plan as potentials?
So should I be paying you for consulting for me for free? I listened to that input by Donald Trump, and I also know that part of what is fueling this hunger for electricity in the US is exactly that. Data centers, Bitcoin mining, in a space that we are moving towards as Eskom, where there's going to be an increasing proportion of renewables into a mix of electricity. Eskom runs the risk of having a lot of part of its market declining. I mean, we've spoken about this. 4% last year is a number we anticipated will stay like that for the next 3-5 years. But you know, the acceleration of renewables means that we have to be turning down our plants. We need to be looking at what are the alternatives. And there's exciting opportunities that we are looking at around AI, data centers, but also within the space of Bitcoin opportunities. The business has to reinvent itself and use part of this baseload that we have in a manner that can help it deal with the remainder of its debt pile that is sitting around our necks here.
Yeah, we've got so much potential in our country. We haven't even started talking about offshore gas where we are supposedly going to be the next great gas province if we can get our investments right. But it's all work in progress, and let's hope that you keep the lights on, and then that in the GNU can keep going, and well, that virtuous cycle can come through. Zipho Buthelezi, who's one of our most active members on the BizNews forums, has got a number of questions, but I know I'm going to put them to you because he is also from your sector. So he's in that area. He says, first of all, what is the role of Eskom in ensuring and enhancing the country's national security?
Baseload power is very critical for a country's energy security. We play a big role in that space. Many of our coal stations still have in excess of 10, 15 years, at least 5-6 of them will be around for a while, till the late 2040s. Medupi and Kusile are still young. They'll be here till the 2060s. Quebec's got 20 more years to go. We see a fissure that has got new Quebec size kind of reactors coming through. Baseload's quite critical for providing the platform for industrial growth from an electricity point of view. And we see Eskom remaining a key player in the space going forth here.
Which country has enhanced its national security through intermittent energy sources like wind and solar?
The example I made, India is really growing rapidly in terms of its own new capacity, but they're doing this on top of their base load. They've not switched off. I think 2 months ago, the UK was very close to blackouts or load shedding, as they call it, because the sun was not there for a number of days. There was no wind. Netherlands also suffered the same.
The sun was not there for a number of days, and that's unusual.
Yeah, well, intensely not there. Yeah, so that's the case. So for us, our view is build renewables on the back of a solid base load. We're doing a gas project in Richards Bay, 3,000 megawatts. As we speak, we're actually negotiating terms for that commercial agreement. It's a very important project because that also helps with the stabilization and dispatchable power in a space of a future that's going to be having a significant portion coming from renewables as well.
Are you still intent on decommissioning coal power plants in Mpumalanga?
We must know that from an engineering perspective, coal plants do have a shelf life. So if you don't take interventions timelessly for life extensions, it almost becomes an irrational act to just keep running them beyond their safety limits. For stations where we can prove the case for extending their lives in a manner that allows us to be using coal responsibly, i.e. within the environmental limits that we have, you should be looking at that. So the decommissioning and commissioning is really dependent per station as we move on. Yeah.
So it's dependent on the economic viability of those coal plants, not on some net zero philosophy that we've adopted.
We have our 2030 emissions targets still intact. Last year, we pronounced on the fact that we are delaying the decommissioning of those stations to deal with the issue of energy security from the energy trilemma perspective. But we also showed a path of how, even when we continue to run Grootvlei, Camden and Hendrina, as opposed to the Komati that we shut down, we showed a path of how the emissions targets for 2030 will still be met.
It sounds like a balancing act, but yeah, the world is changing. So I guess you're going to balance or rebalance as you need to. Ryan the Lion, hey, your tariff increases are unrealistic. Why can't you cost your costs? Would you agree that you have far too many employees?
Let me tackle the issue of too many employees, because it's been in the media for many years, and I've chastised my team for actually not being vocal about it. I think they've been beaten so much in the media that they don't want to defend this. But I'm going to make it easy for you, Alec, to understand. The World Bank study looked at comparative utilities in Europe and the US and looked at the number of employees per megawatt generated by those entities. So the number that was shown as benchmark is in relation to the megawatt generation And you know, you actually normalize that to the number of employees that you have. In a business, the biggest number of employees sit where? In a distribution business. The distribution business, when you account for it in a manner that they wanted to do the adjustments, has a lot more kilometers of lines that they're looking after, because after 1994, we went on an aggressive program as a country to electrify the country. So we got a much more wider network that you are covering. And the World Bank study missed that. The paper was written. There's a guy who's got his PhD based here in Cape Town, in our team, who did all this work, published it, but it's been very quiet. Journalists don't like these things because these are facts and the truth. You can't move away from them. But that's the point. We are not overstaffed. And I'll tell you this: if you look at the staff complement for Eskom, and you know, there's a famous VGB report that was issued last year by National Treasury. VGB is an association of power utilities headquartered in Germany. It does benchmarks. One of the things that came out of the VGB report, other than the fact that Eskom did not have the right processes for procurement, they're cumbersome, they're too bureaucratic. One of the things they pointed out was that Eskom generation was understaffed. You only have to look at the last 5 years or 6 years of the number of intake of young engineers into Eskom. You can see a clear decline, almost from a linear approach to an absolute drop. Why? Because the message that got to the business was that you are overstaffed, and therefore there was no investment in your timber in terms of growing your own timber internally. The end result is that 2 years ago, we then realized that we don't have the right skills in the business, not enough skills in the business. That's why business has come closer to support Eskom with additional resources through the Workstream 1 of the NECOM process, and we've gone back into a recruitment process. It is this messaging that is inaccurate that led the business to really getting to a point of making wrong decisions going forward here. But I'm comfortable that those numbers, we can actually back calculate them and show how they compare with the rest in the utilities.
I think you should do that, and I would take issue that journalists really do want the facts,
Okay,
but
I'm
that's
saying,
when they're journalists. Not all in
not
the group.
analyst. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay.
Not everyone who works in media is a journalist,
Yeah.
basically. Rob Hersoff asked, he says, Dan's doing an amazing job. South Africa's lucky to have such a superb executive like him at Eskom. What does he want from you?
Yeah, that's it.
No,
It's a good man. Yeah.
nice to
Yeah.
say that. Gerard Lumpen says, you achieved something very good. One, do you and the Minister of Electricity get along well?
Oh, yeah. I get along with the minister, I must admit. I'm actually very lucky that I have got a minister who's also an engineer, so we don't explain for too long. He gets it. He's very frank. He gives you feedback there and there. He's very passionate about what he's doing. As you can see, he's on the ground. Yesterday, at very short notice, we decided let's go to a power station in Mpumalanga, and he had to truncate his schedule and deal with cabinet matters. But tomorrow or Friday, he'll be back and say, let's go. We, and my approach, many people ask me, don't you find that the minister is too much in your kitchen? I came onto this job understanding that I'm working on a South Africa project. The non-functioning of Eskom is a risk to the country. So, given what Eskom has done to the country, it's right that there are too many people in the kitchen. It's fine. I'm happy with that. My board is very engaged. I go to NECOM and have to account to other structures within the presidency process. This is a country project. When it's done, we can have a different conversation about who needs to stay in the kitchen. But for now, our focus is on getting out of the state that we are in. Yeah.
It was a point that Teto made as well, that up until the time that he took over, there had been very little engagement between Eskom and its shareholder. But he made that a priority, and clearly you are as well, and we need to be grateful for that. Karat's second question is, some right-wing Afrikaners spread a voice message that blamed the recent blackouts fully on you not paying for oil to spike the coal in KwaZulu-Natal. It sounds like fake news. Your take, please.
Yeah, look, it's fake news. In fact, this was brought to my attention by my deputy minister, deputy minister of electricity. She's very engaged. She's also amazing contribution to our team. We enjoy the leadership that we have from both him and both her and the minister. And she made me aware of that. We can choose to spend time dealing with these things or spend our energy on what is right. I know what caused the outages and I'm upset about it because I've tasted what good feels like and looks like. And I know the team is also upset. We are focused. We need to get load shedding behind us, and people don't have time in the audience writing a whole lot of stories. This is not the only story, there's many others that are there. Yeah.
Fake news is the scourge of our society. And I'm sure being Eskom, you are
Well,
subjected to it often. But I would also urge you to address it when it comes through,
yeah.
because the public need to know. And if there's no rejection of this nonsense, then they might just believe it.
Yeah, but
Pradeep?
Alec, I can also tell you that I don't know if your audience here is aware. When I joined the business, we used to issue media alerts every Friday. There'll be a paragraph or two paragraphs at most. Because of the need to be more transparent, give more information, build data sets for people to understand, I've moved that media alert note from two paragraphs to 2 pages because we tell details. As you pick up issues that are paining society from the reflections on various platforms, we address them in that note. Now, we tell you what has happened this week, how much we have spent on diesel this week, what units are coming back, where we are sitting with our numbers, where are we headed to. We put all of that up on the table. So maybe next time we look out, I may address the issue of some of the fake news issues coming there.
Thank you, Dan. René Roberta says, please confirm if the minimal capacity of running the units is still 80%.
The mean gen.
The minimal capacity of running the units.
No, the turn down is much lower than that. 80% is quite high. So we can turn down many of our units down to about 50% or so. The trick is whether your state of the plant is reliable enough to allow you that level of turn down. And this is what we're looking at. Some of the interventions we are making as we do maintenance and outages is to really help with this because the turn down points are going to be critical in the phase that you are moving to.
Martin Lumpacher wants to know, is there a plan to connect or utilize the excess power being generated by domestic solar systems?
Yeah, that excites me. And I know Cape Town is already doing that in allowing customers to essentially be prosumers, where they generate for themselves and the time when they have excess, they can put into the grid. So the net billing rules that we've been pushing NERSA to get ready is actually the first step in enabling us to get to a point where we can have customers selling to the grid. Our investment that we intend to roll out aggressively within our distribution space with smart metering technology and advanced metering platforms will enable us to be able to do this. There's a lot that we can do in our distribution business to step up to an environment of a market that is changing, and we want to take advantage of that. We do not see the increase in household generation being a threat. You can harness that very creatively by ensuring that the base load that you have gets committed to industries that require firm power for growth. And that's really the mindset shift that we're trying to bring into the business. My distribution team is really focused on the solutions now.
Do you have a timeline on that?
Yeah, we will announce the rollout of advanced metering. An advanced metering program will essentially be dovetailing the program of beginning to encourage rooftop where it is in terms of net billing aspects. We need to make some decisions around what at what level do we play within that space. But the team's brief for this coming financial year is to look for customers that are looking for more firm power and more of it. So we can comfortably look at how to get others off that can afford to be off. And on a net basis, from a country perspective, you'll be fine.
Do you think there's any chance that the 12BA, I think it was, which encouraged massive investment from the private sector into power, into solar power, could be renewed?
Look, as part of the overall solutions, I don't rule that out. What we need to understand is that from a net perspective, a country net perspective, households that are off, you know, industry that's able to do its own generations, is not a bad thing. As we speak, Alec, the chrome industry is facing a real risk of continuously shutting down many of the smelters because there's not enough power or not enough affordable power. So we need to get to a point where as a country, we encourage different uses of electricity from different sources and we take calculated country positions around which industries we want to support and why. 70% of the chrome is in this country. A bulk of it is shipped out to China for further beneficiation. If we are to look at the comprehensive package of solutions to support it, we may end up in a place where solution spaces for electricity looks very different. I'm excited that the DTI is now looking at this. And all of this at the back of you know, the challenge that ArcelorMittal is facing. Yeah.
Have you got any good news for people in my hometown of Newcastle and ArcelorMittal? Can you do anything there to help?
Look, the conversations are still going on from a government perspective. I can tell you that as we speak, there is a product that is sanctioned by the current electricity pricing policy called negotiated pricing agreements. A number of chrome mines are actually on this program. It requires four or five conditions to be fulfilled. One of them is that electricity needs to be above 10% of your input cost for you to qualify. You have to have a particular consumption rate in terms of intensity of utilization of electricity. And then there are a few others. You need to pass all of this for you to qualify for that space. The AMSA applications are looked at within that context as well.
So there is hope. There is hope. How, Billy Oosthuizen asked, how is Eskom going to deal with the poor coal quality issue? Seems to be a recurring theme.
Yeah. We have actually done a lot in terms of coal quality management. And it's not at the point where we would love it to be. We do enforce coal quality checks and the management at Way Bridges, but there's a lot of manual interventions. We need to automate this whole process. By now, we were hoping to have essentially commissioned a very hands-off system developed with one of the technology partners in the country that really deals with mine-to-station, you know, checks along the routes, you know, focuses on even the risk of loads being swapped around to ensure that the coal quality or the coal that we pay for is the quality that we ought to receive. And that program will be launched in the middle of June, finally.
Dan, I can't let you go, and we are running out of time before we go and have our tea, without something that is very emotive to many people here. You were there in the Gupta years. You stood against it. It cost you dearly. What are you guys, you and Mteto, doing about clawing back all that money that was stolen from us as citizens by those crooks?
Look, I must tell you that I found this board in place. They were already a year, 18 months. It were 18 months, a year, 6 months into the job. But they had set up structures that allows us to act on the investigations and also to pursue investigations and on individuals implicated in the Zondo Commission, in the, all those state capture periods. There's a lot. In fact, as we speak, the SIU is detailing some of the cases in Parliament today to the energy portfolio. And I've said to the SIU that I meet with regularly that we need to see some big names really being held accountable to restore public confidence that action is being taken. But there is a very focused team within the business that is driving this. We are dealing with those who are in the business and those who have left the business around this aspect. We're dealing with individuals and organizations, professional organizations and, you know, SMMEs and big business that participated in this area. What's going to make South Africans feel better is when they can see the scoreboard And we are very clear that that's what we need to turn. Yeah.
Well, it's good to know that you've got a vested interest in a way in making sure that this is brought to justice. Chris, you said you had a question. Did you pose it?
Yeah.
Oh, my word. Here we go. This is the last one.
He probably wants me to reduce his municipality bill.
No. Okay, I'll read it. Eskom continues to reticulate electricity despite the constitution making this a local government mandate. Eskom often has the high income generating customers, such as farms and industrial areas. This affects the financial viability of local municipalities because they cannot generate funds as intended when wall-to-wall municipalities were implemented. This also affects municipal ability to implement credit control. For example, we cannot disconnect defaulting customers because they're supplied by Eskom. Is Eskom open to releasing the reticulation of electricity to competent municipalities, or at least entering into an MOU with local government to assist with credit control? After all, it's in all our interests to have functional municipalities.
Yes. No, Chris, thank you for the question. We've not touched on the issue of the Munich debt that Eskom is facing. At the end of this financial year, which is essentially in 2 weeks' time, we estimate we'll be owed about 100 billion rands by municipalities. 100 billion rands. That number moved from 57 late in 2023 and really galloped in the last 2 years and 2.5 years. That debt represents the single biggest risk to the viability of our business going forward and our ability to unbundle the distribution business in line with the reforms that you want to do it. We've got a tool that we can use to switch off municipalities or go to court and take control of their accounts. Or we can go into conversations with municipalities, recognizing that some of them lack capacity, focus, skills, and we have done that with the Maluti Apofo in the Free State. We're now into active partnering with them. We've increased collection rates for revenue for them from about 20-25% to over 65% in a period of 2 months, 3 months. In the process, we are helping them reinvest in their infrastructure so they can serve their customers better. We have a proposal on the table, given the failure of the National Treasury Program that deals with debt relief. Municipalities were essentially invited to come on board, and all they had to do was to keep their current accounts up to date. And for every 12 months they do so, they get a third of their old debt written off. Only 4% are compliant with that. What we see here, Chris, is an issue that's calling for a rethinking around the financing of the municipality. Some of them are too small to be viable. Some are lucky to have big customers within them that they can make them work. But that whole process of municipalities and their viability in as far as banking services are concerned needs to be relooked at. It's happening in water now. There are discussions at the NICOM level to relook at the reforms for electricity distribution. And I think you, through Salga, probably are participating there. We are open to discussing anything that makes us not to be 100 billion rands in the red. I want the money back. If we have to hand it over to you, fine. We'll pay us at the point of transfer and we run. I'm more concerned about the fact that even in these areas where we move in and do active partnering, I know it's a matter of time that those municipalities will be unable to provide other services. So we need to go and address the root problem. And this is a space that our team is now focused on, Chris.
Dan, it's been really good talking with you. I'm as uplifted about Eskom's future as I was in September. And that was a big turnaround. And I think for all members of the BizNews tribe, we now have a much clearer view and a lot more confidence. Rob was right. You're doing a fantastic job. Please keep doing it. And hopefully we all realize that Eskom succeeds, our country succeeds. And we kind of learnt the lesson of that crisis. Yeah. It didn't go to waste. Yeah. Dan Marukani, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here. And get to shop more here. And do more here. And enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence. Renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise, our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.